I've never met anyone in my life so good at BSing as Arjun.
How is that BS, though? That was a legit question.
I don't even believe he has any compassion. After I've seen him BS a couple of times, I've been like, he's a sociopath.
People, 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 Desis, non-Desis alike, welcome. Oh, Jesus. Welcome to another episode of American Desis. I'm Arjun.
I'm Akash.
Guys, this is we're gonna pull it together because we're professionals. In the strongest sense of the word, truest sense of the word. But this is our first interview from DC, yo.
Yeah.
We're finally getting to do a little bit more traveling with the podcast. Thrilled to be in the nation's capital. We have some really exciting interviews that we're gonna get here, and we are starting.
Real quick, we rode the bus to get here, so I want you to know how dedicated we are to this podcast, this pain in my ass podcast.
And how Indian we are in that we didn't want to pay for the train because we wanted those $30 tickets on Megabus. Sprung for those reserve seats, though, folks. Anyway, we are here with someone I'm excited to talk to. We are here with Deepa Iyer. She is an activist, a writer, a lawyer. She also grew up in Kentucky, which we're going to dive into and explore that. But her book is called We Too Sing America, South Asian, Arab, Muslim, and Sikh Immigrants Shape Our Multiracial Future. Deepa, welcome to American Desis.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
And thank you ahead of time for putting up with us
as we My move pleasure. Through today.
Let's dive into the book, I think would be the best place to start. What inspired you? You're a lawyer, and you were the executive director of SALT, South Asian Americans Leading Together, which we'll dive into and what that is a little bit. But what inspired you? At what point did you want to write this book? How did this?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's great to be here to meet you both. Thank you for doing this
we
podcast.
We appreciate you lying up top. I like that. It's a good way to start.
So in terms of the book, you know, what moved me to write it was honestly the work that I've been doing in South Asian American communities since 9/11. The organization SALT was really shaped out of the 9/11 moment. And I wanted to really lift up some of the stories and experiences of people in our communities that we often don't hear about, especially in mainstream media. And so part of the book is really focused on amplifying the experiences of young folks in particular. So you'll notice a book starts with a chapter on Oak Creek, Wisconsin, which the site of a really tragic event, a massacre that took place in 2012. And so as I grew to kind of get to know that community better, I also wanted to document what it is that they had gone through, but also the hope for the future that they stand for as well.
So this book came out in 2015, and it's about a post 9/11, which happened obviously in 2001. At what point did you actually start researching or putting pen to paper?
Sometime in 2014, you know, I had left SALT after 10 years of being the director in 2014. And so after I kind of took some time to chill out and decompress, I started to work on the book.
But you'd been amongst that community, the community since that. So you'd been kind of seeing, you'd almost been doing the research,
exactly.
Since the time.
Yeah, I'd already built the relationships with a lot of the people that appear in the book. And I had worked on many of the issues that are also in the book. So a lot of that kind of knowledge and experience and networks had already been in place. So it was a matter of kind of delving back in and putting, as you said, pen to paper and trying to figure out what the themes were around the book.
So you had themes in mind. What was the biggest surprise or like the biggest discovery you found in the course of actually writing it and that journey itself?
You know, I think a couple of things. One is, so the book looks at the 15 years since 9/11, and it posits that we are at a time where we have three forces coming together, anti-immigrant sentiment, Islamophobia, and racial anxiety because of all the demographic changes in the nation. And I write about the fact that our community, South Asian, Arab, Muslim, and Sikh immigrants, are sort of on the front lines of dealing with those three forces. What was surprising as I was writing the book, and maybe not so surprising, but maybe hopeful and inspiring, was really the passion of young people. You know, I write about people like Eves Gomes, who's an undocumented South Asian immigrant here in Maryland, and about the courage that he has been able to foster in talking about his story, how his parents were deported, what it means to him to be undocumented in the United States, right? And to share that as a South Asian. Those are issues of stigma and taboo, so we don't talk about. So the courage of people like him and others.
And when you say we don't talk about, do you mean we as the South
Asians
Asian community?
Even, yeah. Definitely much less like the broader community, right? But when we learn that, for example, Indians are the fourth largest undocumented population in the U.S., you know, whoa, people are like, what are you talking about, right? Whenever we use those stats.
I didn't know
but
that.
But they're true, yeah.
Wow.
But there is this kind of, you know, we are so used to this Spelling Bee Silicon Valley entrepreneur narrative in South Asian America. And in that way, we dismiss and mask all of the tremendous challenges and smaller successes that people have in our community.
Well, it's actually hard to get them to talk. We've been asking actively for someone to be willing to come on this podcast and speak to, I guess, struggling, for lack of a better word, or like an Indian who's not a doctor, who maybe buses tables.
More than happy to help connect you to folks.
We would love that. But we found, I had the theory that there's we are such an achievement-oriented culture, mm-hmm. at least that's what we brought over, that I worry that the community has not made it safe for people to feel like they can be a part, like they mm-hmm. that there's a shame around if you're, because to me, I'm like, look, man, if you're making an honest living, like providing for your family, like who am I to judge what you're doing? Like,
right.
That's a crazy thing for me.
But I also think that everybody wants to achieve, you know, like every single person in, like, you know, South Asian America, right, wants to achieve. It's just that there are some structural barriers that prevent some people from reaching the successes that other people can. And so, for example, if there is like limited English proficiency, or if someone's poor or working class, or right. if someone is unable to get healthcare or immigration benefits, those are structural problems, not like the individual's issues, right? And so I think part of what the book tries to do is really show how we need to be addressing those structural barriers and not just be focused on this, you know, what I call cultural exceptionalism, that we're such an exceptional community and we have some gene that, you know, helps us be successful. Everybody wants to be successful, right? So the book tries to disrupt some of those narratives we talk about when we really describe our communities.
Do you think
that
taboo is greater in South Asian American communities, or is it pretty much any immigrant community? Because to me, like, African immigrants are also super achievement oriented. Like,
well, I don't. So again, I think everyone's achievement oriented. You know, I think there's like this perception that some groups are more so than others, and I don't actually think that's true.
I mean, maybe this is just me being a stand up, but when I see like white parents just bringing their 13-year-old kid to a comedy club and like, yeah, he wants to be a comedian, I'm like, what are you, right? Like, you're just gonna let him do what makes him happy? That's psychotic. What does it even mean? Be happy. Go make money, right? Like, that's my whole thing. But yeah, our perception is that white Americans are much more about do what makes you happy, whatever it is. If you love bussing tables, bus tables.
I don't know that I would say that. I've seen that across the board, but I do think that that's a more pervasive in the non-immigrant community.
Mm-hmm.
I would phrase it that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But what did you? Did that answer your question, or have you?
I was just saying. I don't know, disagreeing or whatever, but you just said, like, it's kind of everybody, but I don't know that it's everybody. I think it's very strong.
Well, when I say everybody wants to achieve, I mean in the sense that everybody wants to be able to get a good education. Everybody wants to be able to make a living, right?
Right.
Those are not, like, necessarily limited to a particular group.
Oh, so this is a different kind of achievement.
Yeah,
I think
exactly. Yeah, I'm not talking about, like,
right.
the financial
okay,
success. Yeah, I'm more talking about an equal opportunity.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
But just to kind of respond,
yeah,
like,
please.
Finish up what you were saying, which might segue into something else, which around the surprising part. The surprising part about this book has actually been the reception to it and the when it came out. So it came out in November of last year, and I thought, well, you know, it may or may not be received, right? But what was happening at that time, as you remember, is that we started to get the lead up to the election. The Paris attacks occurred. The attacks in San Bernardino occurred all in November. And so what has happened, interestingly, as I've been on the road with the book, is that people of all backgrounds, not just Desi people, are interested in having these conversations about what kind of America are we living in and building, right? And so I think the book has been hopefully has been important in helping people frame their understanding of what life is like for South Asian, Sikh, Muslim, and Arab immigrants, and also what it means for the future.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I just had a thought. It's horrifying and yet required almost that these violent occurrences or these tragedies are what allowed for people to stop being invisible.
Yeah.
Trump putting us on the map, baby.
Trump, I mean, if we can take a silver lining from these sort of things, but that's actually really interesting that there's now an increase. And what a beautiful thing
that there's
now a conversation is beginning.
I'm sorry to interrupt again, but we had Dr. Varun Soni on. He's a really intelligent guy.
Your man crush.
I have a giant man crush on him, unabashed, however you say it. But he talked about how our community might not be as united because there haven't been.
The Hindu community.
Yeah, I guess the Hindu, he said. He spoke to Hindus, but there hasn't been a lot of tragedies to bring the community together, and that you kind of, the idea is that you just kind of need some oppression or tragedy or something to bring a community together, and then so the silver lining could be this brings the South Asian community closer together.
Well, I mean kind of started the question of like how could we create a community without that. But my question to you about this book was, did you have a specific audience in mind? Was it more specific to the South Asian, or was it to this grander conversation when you wrote it?
Yeah, so I think I was interested in speaking to younger people. I teach often at the University of Maryland here, and I
Terrapins.
That's right. And I noticed that, and I teach in the Asian American Studies program, and I noticed that in my classes, you know, a lot of the students were like 4 or 5 years old when 9/11 happened, and they have a very sanitized understanding of what post 9/11 America is, right? So they remember certain things, like big moments, you're with us or you're against us, President Bush saying, or they remember the Patriot Act, but they have gaps of knowledge in terms of all the other policies that occurred beyond the Patriot Act. They have a gap of knowledge in terms of what it's like for Muslims to live in the U.S. and what it's like for people who are perceived as Muslims. And so part of their goal in writing the book is to fill some of those information gaps. And so it's written in a way that I think appeals to maybe younger audience, accessible to younger audiences.
Right.
And so colleges are starting to use it, for example, in some of their ethnic studies classes or South Asian studies classes. And it's also focused on young people. Like the activists that I profile in the book are, for the most part, under the age of 35. You know, some of them are right out of, you know, just college graduates. But they're on the front lines of shifting some of the narrative in their own communities about what it's like to be South Asian or Muslim or Arab in the U.S.
Now, did you focus these on just the D.C. Maryland area, or were they all
national.
Across the
yeah. yeah, so Oak Creek is in there, and then
oh, of course,
yeah, and then there are other, you know, there's a chapter on Murfreesboro, Tennessee. I've spent some time, you know, in Kentucky, as we talked about, and also in Tennessee. And so those are communities that are dear to me. And in Murfreesboro, which is about a half an hour outside of Nashville, there is a community there, a Muslim community that was seeking to build a mosque. And for about 4 years, they faced tremendous obstruction in terms of just getting a mosque constructed, right? Mm-hmm. So everything from the people in the community going to like a town hall commission meeting saying, no, like we're worried about these jihadists, right, who are building this mosque and we're at war with Islam. I mean, very coded and sometimes direct language that is Islamophobic and xenophobic to litigation to stop the mosque from being constructed. So they had to deal with all of that in the course of 4 to 5 years. So I profile like how that community responded, what the impact is, and also this industry of Islamophobia that exists in the U.S. and how it's using places in the South, for example, as a testing ground to push some of this anti-Muslim rhetoric and anti-Muslim legislation.
So I have a question about the subtitle of the book, South Asian, Arab, Muslim, and Sikh Immigrants Shape Our Multiracial Future. It's interesting that they are all separated.
That's what I was noticing.
And I'm curious, I feel like from the outside, we are all like put together as one community. And I would love if I felt like we all were. Mm-hmm. I don't always know that we are.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like sometimes, is that something, you are more entrenched in the community than I am. So I would love to hear your take on that.
Yeah.
And what your, whether you see a shift in that. Do you think that there can be a shift in that? Because to me, it feels like the things won't shift unless we are
right.
a community.
Right.
That's like my big yeah. thing is about community yeah. in general. It's part of why we started the podcast. So I'd love to hear what you yeah. what you think about that.
It's a great observation for having had no sleep.
I mean, I'm killing the game right
you
now.
Are.
I feel like
I
feel
did you? I'm actually thinking you read the book.
I have.
Other than
I have
the back
not.
Of it,
he's
I know you haven't. I'm really joking.
He's an incredible BSer.
I was like,
it's crazy it's how not, well
you must have read the table not, of I'm, contents no, in the back.
I've never met anyone in my life so good at BSing as Arjun.
How is that BS though? That was a legit question.
I don't even believe he has any compassion after I've seen him BS a couple of times.
You actually maybe
he's a sociopath,
maybe. But I know you didn't.
I'm going to though.
No, so you're right. Like the reason that I explicitly mention those communities in that way is to make it clear that not all experiences are the same, right?
Right.
So the way in which Islamophobia affects Muslims in this country is not how it affects Hindus, right? And so non-Muslim South Asians. So I wanted to make it clear that the experiences are unique at some level. And a woman wearing a hijab is going to experience Islamophobia in a way that's very different than, say, me, right, who's not Muslim and who doesn't, who's not going to present as Muslim. So part of it was to not flatten experiences by using, a South Asian American perspective,
right.
but actually make it clear that the experiences are different. But when you read the book, not if, you'll see that there's a chapter on identity. And I talk about how, you know, the identities that we have built, like South Asian American, or after 9/11, we built another one called MASA, Muslim Arab South Asian, which a lot of people don't know about.
Oh, yeah.
We use it like in the activist circles, or even the Asian American identity, right? That all of these are politically constructed identities that serve a political purpose. It's to show, for example, that we are united in terms of some of the policies that we wish to see that could change the lives and conditions of our people. But that doesn't mean that we're all the same. So I think that the identity, political identity or identity politics or however people want to talk about it, has to be framed from a politic. You know, what is your orientation to government, to institutions? What is your take on racism? How do you relate to other people of color? Those are the ways I feel we can come together.
But I find that so many people distance themselves from like, oh, that's like a Muslim problem,
mm-hmm.
or that's like a Sikh problem.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's not really. Even I'm wondering how we create that this is our problem.
Yeah.
Like how?
By showing, I think, a few things. Right. That first of all, stories. You know, to connect people, right? So when someone reads about or understands what happened at the Oak Creek Gurdwara, it's not a far-flung, perception that it could happen at a temple,
right.
a Hindu temple, right? That these are our people. Like, we can't keep saying, well, that just happened to the Sikhs in Oak Creek. Well, it could happen to the Hindus in, you know, New York City,
has. I don't know if I'm going to word this question
yeah.
well because I'm so tired, but by separating everything,
mm-hmm.
doesn't it take a certain level of enlightenment that not a lot of people have to say, well, we're separate, but this could happen to us, and we all need to work together? By separating the identities, doesn't it kind of lend itself to what Arjun said of like, well, that's not us?
I don't think so. I think that people have to interrogate their political identities, right? Like, you have to actually get into conversation with yourself to be like, okay, you know, I might be, say, an Indian in the United States, and maybe I don't experience post 9/11 discrimination in the same way that someone Muslim is or someone from Pakistan, but what is my political orientation, right? I mean,
right.
I think that it's a matter of, and I see people do this constantly, especially, you know, college students, where people are getting to that point of seeing themselves as, I have my unique identity and my unique experiences, but I'm connected. You know, it's tiers, right? So I'm connected to another community, which is broader than me. And I'm connected to the community of people of color. So I see that more so in the
I see what you're saying. I think that's a really powerful point. It's that before we start, it's almost an interesting catch-22 or circular thing. I need to know myself before I can become a part of a community, and then the community
yeah.
will help serve myself.
Yeah,
each
person has to situate themselves, I think, as
right.
a person of color. Right, you have to start there. If you think you're not, and if you, then I don't even think that my book is going to be relevant to you at all, right?
Right.
So when you realize, when you have that orientation, that self-orientation.
But I think that's a really fascinating
yeah.
issue within the South Asian community.
Absolutely.
just that first point
yes.
is a really fascinating point of like this identifying with whiteness and identifying
you
with the power structure.
You must have.
I didn't sleep because I was just so engrossed in We Too Sing
right.
America. I had the advanced copy. I hacked and no. But that's something that we've
right.
definitely experienced, and that's like it's always a really crazy and just like I don't know how to even I wish I knew how to respond better when I heard that. Mm-hmm. I wish I like had the technique, and maybe that's something that you or when we get to the people talk to the people at Salt, they might have better techniques. But
yeah.
I'm always like I want to not like shame them or be like you're fucking crazy. But
right.
a part of me is like what?
I agree. Yeah, I mean sociologists call it the racial bribe, you know, that is given to non-black people of color primarily, right? To be like. You know, if we think of the racial hierarchy in this country as a ladder with white people on top and blackness at the bottom, whiteness on top and blackness at the bottom, then people who are they see, for example, are often given the racial bribe, the invitation to climb the ladder and to aspire to whiteness. Some people take it, right? And when you take it, it winds up as someone who's apathetic, who doesn't see themselves as a person of color, who's not connected to any of these issues. And part of what I think in the book, at least, I talk about is to disrupt that process. Like, don't take the bribe, don't take the racial bribe, but disrupt the ladder entirely, dismantle the ladder and the structures that set it up. And part of that means also being aligned with black people in this country. And that's a critical point of the book as well.
Well, I remember there was this brilliant playwright that I worked with, an Asian American, East Asian American playwright, who called the Suitcase Trilogy. And there was a line in here, he was like, he just said, everyone must know their cage.
Mm.
And it was just like this really, I remember I was like a sophomore in college when I read, and I was just like, it blew, I was like, whoa. Because he was talking about that, like, everyone has a cage that society puts on. I mean, he was a
yeah.
pretty dark and, like, not a happy dude. But
yeah.
if you strip away the darkness of it and just think of, like, everyone has a box that society then puts you in, it's not, like, you have to look in the mirror and know that, like, this is what people think of you.
Mm-hmm.
That you can think yourself to be in a
outside
of that box.
Yeah.
But and you are, because in truth, like, we are more expansive than
sure.
any box that can be put in. But I think it's really important, and you've talked about this a lot, to know what other people are seeing you as.
Mm-hmm.
If for nothing else, you can arm to try to break that.
Mm-hmm.
So this, yeah.
I agree. Yeah, and I think that's why, you know, disrupting some of the narratives that we hear, disrupting the conversations that we have at our families, right, about, like, the cultural exceptionalism or better or whatever, that is part of how I think we shift, right? So one, getting to know ourselves and being clear about who we are, but then secondly, to start disrupting some of the narratives that are in place that prevent us from getting out of the box or dismantling the system.
I really love this term, disrupting.
Thanks.
Really
it's one of my favorite
yeah.
words now.
Yeah, it's really, it's like really evocative. It's really active in a fun way. Let's talk about more ways to disrupt.
Yeah.
Is it just, I mean, for me as an artist, like, it's very tangible, like, tell stories. Like, I get that. But what about people that aren't? Artists
yeah.
or like that aren't telling stories. What things?
Well, you
can,
know, one of the I think the most simple but the hardest thing to do to disrupt is a conversation in your house with your family,
ooh.
Right? And those are the hardest conversations to have. And I think when I've gone,
South Asian families, to
yeah,
talk.
Right. If they talk, right? If we
luck.
Talk, yeah.
That's such a stereotype. And you just met my parents. That like I've never understood because like we always. Talk too much. I mean, I know. Wait, you're talking about real stuff.
Talk, not we don't speak at
right.
all, but I'm talking about talking.
Right. I'm with you now.
Being
yeah.
open.
Yeah.
Or even disrupting is actually introducing a conversation topic, right, in a family
yeah.
that's not open to
yeah.
talking about stuff that's hard or serious. But I think, you know, for example, I ask people to take these pledges of action at my book discussions, right, and to have race talks. Right.
Okay.
How are you going to have race talks? What kind of disruption are you going to do? And so a lot of people basically come back with, I'm going to have a conversation with my Indian grandfather about the movement for Black Lives, right? Or I'm going to interrupt a conversation with my family or my aunts and uncles that are perpetuating anti-Muslim stereotypes, right? Mm-hmm. Those are hard things to do, especially right. with the people that we're closest to. We usually tend to shy away from those disruptions. We don't want to deal with it. We think they'll never change.
Well, so it's also like there's a strong respect your elders
that too
that we've
yeah.
been taught, and there's truth to that. And so it's how to. There's almost like if you question your elders, you're somehow disrespecting them.
But there's a way to do it, right? Like disruption isn't like, hey, you're wrong.
Right.
Yeah. It's a process and it leads people, you know, take some time. I mean, I think about like my mom, for example, you know, she would never talk about anything related to like race issues, right? But because I think I've been doing this work for some time and I talked to her about some of this stuff. A couple of years ago, she called me and she was like, Deepa, I think I was racially profiled at the airport, right? She never used those words. But for her to even see herself as like a person of color, a woman of color, that, you know, that she could be singled out for something, I do think it's possible to move our parents' generation. I think it takes a lot of time and a hell of a lot of patience.
Right. Okay, so disrupting within, you have a question.
I actually want to know when this activist, thread within you or whatever the word is, when did you become an activist? That's a simple way to ask.
So I grew up in India till I was 12 in Kerala and moved to the U.S. when I was 12 to Kentucky, of all places.
Kentucky. Were there a lot of Indians
Louisville?
Then?
You know, there was a small community of Indians, but it was really small.
Right. That's crazy culture shock.
Yeah, it was kind of intense, especially as an adolescent.
South. You know what I mean? You did to get that.
You did to go
it's
south
like a double
south.
Bind, right? You're 12 and you're in the South. It's just not fun. I mean, you grew up in Texas,
places.
I guess.
I grew up in Texas. It was rough, but at least you were in both places in the South and surrounded by Christians. So, you know, you had those two things in common.
And I went to all Catholic schools. I'm not Catholic, but yeah, it was really strange. I don't think that I was very aware. I was aware, you know, from the time I got here, like most of us are, right, that I was different and I didn't fit in. And especially in Kentucky, race was really a black or white paradigm.
Right.
Yeah. And so I had no idea where I fit in there. I was went through a lot of racial confusion. But I think as many other 1.5 generation South Asians do, was focused more on, well, how do I preserve my culture? Like, what parts do I keep and what parts do I leave out, right, in order to fit in? That was really the inquiry that was in my mind.
Did you think you were conscious of that?
Actively conscious of that?
Yeah. Or was that just kind of
I would think about, like, this thing about how can I have my feet in both worlds? I remember, like, journaling about that when I was, like, 15 or whatever, right? So, but I think a lot of people think that way, right? Like, what is it that's in, like, when constructing the hyphenated Indian American identity, what is Indian in me and what is American? So I was conscious of that. But I was also conscious of the fact that we were treated differently at times, right, because of who we were. And I think that that part, even though it wasn't very nuanced and wasn't very developed, was something that I did think about in college, right? So I went to college in the South again in Nashville, Tennessee.
Oh, wow.
Vanderbilt? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So very few people of color, but there were people of color who, at the time, I mean, I went to college a while back. I don't
so
want to.
Tell you
if you guys could have seen her searching for a way to not say her age. That's a real
thing. No, I'm proud of my age. I'm proud of my age.
We're
going to need to get into that here.
Be that.
Be that. All right, I'm trying to.
This is a perfect example of that brown don't frown, because I wouldn't know.
I'm trying to embrace my early 40s. Okay.
Shocking.
There you go.
It's not, yeah, see, that's that brown don't frown, people. I'm saying, man, we have advantages. We are not completely screwed.
You,
thank God for
maybe
the cultural
muscle mass
genes.
Is what ages you, and since we don't got none.
I do. I'm sorry, we've gone off track. We're doing so well.
That's
we're
what I do,
so
baby.
Well. Let's go back. Okay.
Yeah, so.
Call it Vanderbilt.
I'm disrupting.
Not that.
Yeah, disrupting is not interrupting.
Hey, you know, you gotta let me do it how I do it.
So you're in Vanderbilt, and it's a not.
Yeah.
Very diverse experience.
Yeah. But
so we're
still
tracking how your activism was born.
But I think there were people there on campus, like students of color, who I learned from, who were focusing on things like, who were focusing on things like how do we expand the diversity of the faculty? How do we get more, you know, study like Asian American studies classes or whatever? So I learned from them in terms of the importance of systems responding to the needs of people of color, right? Then went to law school, and I feel like I'm giving you my whole trajectory here.
Listen, that's what we want.
Also went to a very, a white school, Notre Dame, Catholic. I have this thing with the Catholic schools.
Your identity, sorry to interrupt you, but was there an identity, like, because you were conscious of it at the age of 15, like how to fit in both worlds. What was your experience of that as you were going through these like, very white...
I'm also curious about how they perceived you.
Okay. I don't know how they perceived. I mean, I think I've always felt like I was on the outside, right, of whatever America is, and didn't feel like I really belonged, except in the spaces where I was with my tribe. So whether it was my people or other people of color, and that continues to be the case for me, and I think it always will be. But in college, you know, I was active with the Indian Students Association, helped to start that on campus. So I think more about developing an Indian American identity more so than anything else. And then in college, in law school.
So you took the initiative upon yourself to say, like, this is not present here.
Yeah. I mean,
so you could almost say
me and two other people. Yeah.
Sure. But like, you were part of that. Like, that's, to me, that would be already activism in some way. Or would you not agree
No,
with that?
I do. I do. I think at the time, I'm not sure that it was like,
coming from that
from
space.
That space, right? It was more that, oh, we need a place to like have our Diwali events, right? I mean, it wasn't necessarily about, but I think by the time I got to become a senior, you know, and I had been schooled by other students of color on campus, we were talking about politics. Right. We were having discussions around maybe
but
we didn't
even disrupting just like a cultural event, even is that not political in its own way?
It is, but I challenge students now to use their cultural events, which are they're rather large at some college campuses, right? Or like the Bunger competitions. But use those because you have a wide audience. So what I challenge students to do is to use those as a way to send a message around what does it mean for us to be people of color in the United States right now.
This is what I love about what I'm hearing from you so much is about our responsibilities. That's what I keep hearing. You talk about a pledge to action. You've talked about what students like have. That's really great. Like, we do take for granted, like, the response. Because we take for granted the power that we have, like,
the
influence that we have, and the privilege that we have, that we do get to be in an education, like, institution like that. Yeah, that's really that's cool.
And I think this moment right now is so important because, you know, the movement for Black Lives, the undocumented youth movement, there is a lot going on right now that young people can get involved in, and that can help to move us towards understanding like who we are as individuals, situating ourselves as people of color, but then also situating our racial solidarities. So situating our racial identities and our racial solidarities, I think, is the critical task of all people who are South Asian in America.
I know we've taken you off, and we'll take you back to that question, but I'm curious, what has the reception been when you bring this, like when you say, hey, have a message with that? What are college students?
Yeah.
Are they being receptive to that, or are they saying, older person telling us what to do?
No, older person, hey.
Older than an 18-year-old? I'm older to these people.
So I think, you know, it's been interesting.
You're stepping over that one, dog.
I mean,
can you edit that out? that kind of negates your brown, don't frown.
Oh, man. That's what I learned about women. They hear the negative in everything.
I mean,
it's a constant landmine field you're walking with every sentence.
I mean, who's not older than a 17-year-old? That's what I'm saying. Like,
a 16-year-old, which is what she looks like. Bam!
Oh, good job!
I'm learning,
good
baby.
Good job.
I'm learning.
You're redeamed. You are redeemed.
Oh, my girl heard that. She hears I'm learning. You know what I mean?
Yes.
No, I think, you know, it's so definitely, I think college students are receptive because. Ooh. You know, many college campuses now have active social justice leanings, right? I mean, again, like in Maryland, where I teach often, you know, there's a really large movement for Black Lives conversation happening. And there are Asian Americans and South Asians involved in that. What I think is interesting has been talking to non-South Asians And also talking to first gen South Asians, right? So I did a talk. Well, like our parents' generation mainly, or newer immigrants who are from South Asia. So I did a talk at the Hindu temple in Nashville, Tennessee, which was really, you know, scary for me. I'd grown up in that temple practically when I went to school at Vanderbilt. And it was nerve-wracking to say words like anti-blackness and racial privilege in that group. But I also feel like that is a form of disruption. You know, it's easier for me to go and talk to a South Asian Students Association on a campus, much easier, right?
Interesting.
Than it is to go talk to a group, you know, like a group of first generation, our parents, you know, 60 plus Indian Americans, uncles and aunties. So I think that those have been interesting in terms of what I hear back from folks. And what I will say is that I've been really inspired by a lot of the first generation folks that I've talked to. You know, I did something in Austin, Texas, an Indian American community there, Nashville. I mean, I've been doing more of those to first generation folks, and people get it. You know, I think people understand that they themselves, even if they don't talk about it explicitly, that they have been subjected to some form of discrimination or bias or injustice, or they perceive it, or they see it with their children because their children are talking about it more openly.
Right.
And I think that there are ways for us to, you know, I don't think we should dismiss the first generation. I think sometimes we do, to kind of be like, okay, let's just focus on everyone younger, right? But I think that it is important to still bridge, and we need their stories. You know, I was talking to some folks in Tennessee who work at, you know, a lot of black institutions, right? Educational institutions in Nashville. Like historically black institutions or like engineering professors and the like. And the way that they talk about what black folks have endured in this country is an important message for, I think, the rest of us to hear, because they get it.
Well, I also know that for, you know, my parents, you know, when they came down to Florida, they experienced the type of racism and prejudice that I've not. At least not. It was more open.
Mm-hmm.
For them, that they had to, like language was much less coded back then.
Right.
So, I mean, those are important.
You grew up in Tampa and had like coded language racism.
Yeah, I definitely had.
That's kind of why I asked you about Kentucky and how people perceive you, because the racism in the South can be much more open and less coded, I guess.
I think it was a lot of.
Not all the time, but when it was there was a
it's pretty direct.
Yeah, there were some times where it's like, yeah.
It's pretty direct. I mean, that's what I found in Kentucky, but Florida is different maybe. But, you know, there are places.
Yeah, Tampa is a bit more of a diverse. I mean, there's like a big Cuban population. There's a big Latino population. So I wonder if that makes it shift a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I do think the demographics make a huge difference, like in terms of who you grow to school with and what you're used to. But certainly in Kentucky in the mid to late 80s, it wasn't. You know, it was not, it was pretty clear what people thought of you, whether you fit in or if you didn't. But it has shifted. I just went back to my high school to do a talk, you know, it was really interesting to talk to a group of, I went to an all-girls Catholic high school, to talk to a group of seniors, like 250 seniors, again, primarily all white. But I found that the way that they engaged with me and talked about some of the questions that they were asking were actually made me feel a lot more hopeful about even folks growing up in the South now. Things have shifted.
So I want to go back to this activist question from a different angle. We introduced you as an activist, a writer, and an attorney, and a lawyer. Are all three of those separate, or are they all really?
You mean like the title of the book?
Yeah. No, but like, do they all seem to tie into each other? Do you write outside of that, or is all of your writing more like? That's more what I mean. Like, do you have writings that you do that is more like just like, I don't know, like a narrative short story?
No, not really. So I wish I had like a creative bone in my body. No, I don't. I think, you know, I started off kind of doing much of my work has been in the racial justice movement in the nonprofit sector. Okay. And so the writing has really is something new in terms of at least in terms of the book even. But it really comes. I do it in service to the movement for racial justice. My hope is that people will read the book and better understand what it is like to live in post 9/11 America, and will better understand our communities, and then will actually take some action steps. And the book is full of you know, the end of the book is called Race Talks, and it just has like a list of questions that you can be engaged with in terms of having conversations, right? So one of my friends, Anirvan Chatterjee, whom you should interview, he and his partner, run this like really awesome historical walking tour in Berkeley called the Bay Area Walking Tour, and they focus on South Asian. South Asian.
It's crazy.
They have these and they take you on the tour and they show you like places that are related to South Asian American history.
Oh, wow.
It's amazing.
Yeah. We're gonna be up in San Fran, so we'll do that.
I'll totally connect you. They're great. Awesome. And so he says the book is like from 9/11 to 2042, and that is kind of true. The book looks at, you know, where we're headed when we, in 2042, the country will become a nation where people of color will be the primary majority population, right? And so the questions that I'm asking is, well, how are we preparing as South Asian Americans for that moment, right? How are we preparing now to be actually able to take advantage of some of the opportunities that sort of multiracial nation could provide us? But in order to do that, we have to be clear about who we are as people of color, and we have to be in solidarity with other people of color.
And that's the in solidarity is one thing that I really hope that we can come to. Is the book the full time? Are you also, is that the full time thing now?
No,
or are you?
Yeah. So I am. So I right now have a fellowship that I am working through. So I am working at an organization. I'm hosting the fellowship at an organization called the Center for Social Inclusion, which is up in New York City. And CSI focuses on structural racism and structural equity. And so the.
What does a fellowship mean?
The fellowship means that I just got, you know, very fortunate to be able to spend some time working on this book and getting the book out there. So I'm basically doing these community conversations all around the nation where I do a book talk around the book, read from the book a bit, but then I'm in conversation with local activists who actually live in those communities, right? Mm-hmm. Who are reflecting on what's happening in their communities and talking about campaigns or initiatives that are going on to lift their voices up. And then we do sort of this pledge to action, right? Well, where do we go from here? And so so I'm doing those all around the country and would love it if folks, you know, wanted to be involved. Like there's a Facebook page for We Too Sing America.
Yeah, I mean, this is a perfect time to,
Before we get in the plug, can I ask one more question? We usually wrap up with a plug.
Yeah.
Simple question. Can you explain We Too Sing America?
Oh,
why
Why
Sing America?
So We Too Sing America is, you know, loosely based on the very inspiring poem by Langston Hughes called I Too. And so when he wrote that poem, he was talking about how Black people are not allowed at, say, like the dining table or the kitchen table because they are relegated to the back of the kitchen, right? They're not allowed to be up front. And he talks about how in his poem that the Black community is growing strong and will actually have a seat at that table or will be recognized for their full contributions and their histories. And so it's based on that, right? It's based on his poem. But I kind of mean it as both subversive and inclusive. So We Too Sing America is that, you know, our communities, despite being in this country for quite some time and contributing to this country in so many ways, are still outsiders, are treated as outsiders, primarily because, at least from my book standpoint, the post 9/11 policies that have occurred and the narrative of Islamophobia and xenophobia. And that we, So it's partly that's subversive, that we're still not American, right? But it's also to say that we are singing America in our own ways. Like we are actually reshaping and reconfiguring what it means to be American.
Right.
And the people in the book that I profile are, I feel, doing that.
Is sing different than say, you know, instead of saying say, like was this sing?
So that's the Langston Hughes poems, is the I Too Sing America.
Oh,
yeah,
gotcha.
Yeah. So it's really like trying to evoke, you know, kind of evoke what he was talking about, connected to our communities as well. Also in that move for solidarity. Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Okay.
Now. Plug time?
Plug time,
yes.
Sure.
And how they can get at you.
Yeah,
where they can get at
absolutely.
The book. And it'd be kind of cool to end with the pledge to action.
Sure.
If that's not like a terribly long thing.
Maybe you guys could give your pledges to action too.
Sure. He's not going to pledge nothing.
I'm not going to take any action, so why lie?
Well, but doing this podcast is is in a way action, you know.
Yeah, no, but you're asking for a lot more solidarity than I'm really willing to give at this point.
Like, at least not today.
I keep it South Asian. When you start going beyond that, I'm like, yeah, right.
That's a start. I guess you'll have to hold it down for him.
What are we talking about?
Well, it's the plug. Let's dive into the Facebook page.
If folks are interested in purchasing the book, I encourage you to pick it up at an independent bookstore in your area, so we can support independent bookstores. Secondly,
you are an activist through and through, huh?
Is it also
on
Amazon?
Can't even go to Barnes & Noble. No, you can't go to Amazon. You got to go to it.
It's if you can't, if you like don't have, if you live in like Tampa and don't have like independent bookstore somewhere.
Is that true?
I don't know.
Yeah. What about a pledge to action, Arjun?
You can order it.
I also want to pledge that this book gets read.
You can order it off the website of my publisher, The New Press.
Love that.
There are other entities that you can also visit.
New Press, though.
Sure,
go to newpress.com. Newpress.com.
Figure out. And then, but in addition, I would love it if, you know, more than reading the book, also people came out to the conversations, because I think that's where the real work happens. And so the information on that is either on the We Too Sing America Facebook page, or you can just go to my website, which is www.deepaiyer.com. It's IYER.com, and I'll be in New York and a bunch of other places in the next couple of months. Oakland.
That's awesome.
So hopefully we'll get to see folks face to face.
Are you on Twitter? Is that a part of your?
Twitter is great at DV Iyer, and you can also email me at Deepa@deepaiyer.com.
Amazing. Well, Deepa, thank you so much for coming. This was a fascinating conversation. Marty, loving D.C. I love this town, man. It's a great town. Guys, we're going to do our small little plug very quickly. On our Facebook, as we post these things nowadays, it'd be really great. A lot of people are liking them, and we really appreciate that. If you can just slide your mouse over right about like 3 inches to that share button, just click that for us. That's a really great tool to help us grow the community that we're talking about. So we'd really appreciate it if you did that.
He was even nicer to you because he wants to take a pledge to action. I am taking no such pledge. I refuse to talk to you and coddle you like Arjun. Like the goddamn post. Share the goddamn post. Get on iTunes. Give it 5 stars. Write a glowing review, you stupid idiots.
Oh, God.
You have done nothing. Take a pledge to action.
Can we switch?
Take
so
a
that-
pledge to... Some G-damn action around
Can
here.
Can we switch so that at least I do the positive last?
No.
From now on?
No.
Can
I
we
refuse.
End with that?
I refuse.
All right. What's this pledge? Real quick. What is this? Let me see. What is it like?
So
it's like
it's
a pledge
anything,
allegiance kind of thing?
Not at all.
I thought that's what it was. I thought it was like a poem we were going to say together. Oh, no, I just pledged some action. I'm doing this podcast. That's my pledge.
Wait, you can't do that. That was
no, a, that's his? All right, I'll pledge. Okay, I
so it's
pledge.
Anything. It's like, you know, to take a race.
South Asians.
That actually is good. That's
see?
Good. Yeah.
It's
talking to South Asians.
I never said you were.
Could be like, you know, I pledged to do, to have a race, you know, a talk about race or South Asian American. With my family, or I pledge to, you know, share information, right, about these communities, or I pledge to sign a petition. It can be anything that's
right.
Like, it doesn't
so
have
I
to be like a heavy
to,
lift.
I pledge to disrupt conversations that I see, and I pledge to use my platform that I'm building to start talking about stuff and continue to talk about stuff.
That's
and,
great.
And continue to use this podcast. So, come back next week for our podcast to check out the dope new interview that we have. I'm not sure if the community episode's next week or not because I'm lost in what the schedule is. But something's going to be happening next week. So you come back and you listen, please.
Yeah, support us and support Deepa. She's clearly a super, super, super smart woman. And she put up with Arjun's pretending to be really smart and my not even pretending I'm not stupid for a second. So we appreciate that.
I'm Arjun.
I'm Akash.
And we'll catch you next week.
God bless.